Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and you can call me here on the program in the coming hour if you have questions about the Bible or about Christianity, or if you have a difference of opinion from the host you'd like to express on something this host has said on a previous broadcast, feel free to call me. We have one line open right now, and that's at 1-800-438-5090. All through the show, that's the number you can call to reach me on the air, 1-800-438-5090. Before we go to the phones, I'd like to let our Las Vegas area listeners know that I will be answering questions in a home to anyone who wants to come out there. I've done this a number of times before. This is going to be in Henderson, and you know where that is. And if you want information about the specific location, feel free to look at the website. The address and the phone number for directions can be found there at our website, which is thenarrowpath.com. And you go to the announcements link, and there you'll find information about where the meeting is going to be. All right, and that's this Friday at 7 o'clock in Henderson. Look forward to seeing some of our listeners there this weekend. Let's talk to Tyler, who's calling from Tacoma, Washington, first of all. Hi, Tyler. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hey, Steve. How you doing today?
All right.
I'm good. I was going to take this call off the air because I'm sitting on the side of the freeway. It's probably pretty loud. So.
Okay.
But I've heard you talk about the amillennialist view a little bit, and I was wondering if you could kind of shed some light on it for me. I don't know if this question has been asked a bunch of times, but... I was just kind of wondering, like, if it's a non-literal thousand-year reign or whatever, if it's figurative or whatever, then could you explain some of the things about it to me, like what exactly it does mean, what it's talking about? For example, like when Satan is bound up for the thousand years, what it means when the first resurrection, what that's talking about. Could you just kind of explain some of that to me, and I'll take that off the air.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for your call.
Yeah, good to talk to you. Thanks.
Okay, you too. All right, well, the millennial question is always tied up with the interpretation of Revelation chapter 20, because Revelation chapter 20 is the only place that mentions this thousand years that we call the millennium. Now, the premillennial view, which is probably more popularly known in American evangelicalism today, holds the view that the thousand years is a literal thousand-year period that will be initiated when Jesus returns. And therefore, they believe that Jesus comes before the millennium. And that view is called premillennialism, because they believe in a premillennial second coming of Christ. So that's one view, and that's probably the most popular view in America today. It certainly was not the most popular view throughout most of church history, and I don't even think it necessarily is throughout the world today. It's the American evangelicalism, probably more than anything else, that has really been enamored with the premillennial view in the last 100 years or so. But the amillennial view is the view that the thousand years is symbolic. Now, what is it symbolic of? Well, we see it in Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 through 3, that Satan is bound with a chain. Actually, it says the dragon is bound with a chain and thrown into a pit and put a lid on top of. And he remains there for about 1,000 years. And then at the end of that time, he is loosed. He goes out and deceives the world and threatens God's people. But fire from heaven comes down from and destroys the wicked. And then we have the resurrection and the judgment described at the end of the chapter. So we have the binding of Satan. We have the 1,000 years during which he is bound. We have a little season at the end of the 1,000 years where he's loosed briefly. And then we have the destruction of Satan and of the wicked, followed by the resurrection and the judgment. That's the order of things in Revelation chapter 20. Now, the amillennial view believes that the binding of Satan is not a reference to the second coming of Christ. It's a reference to the first coming of Christ. That when Christ came the first time, as he told us, he bound the strong man and was spoiling his house strong man being Satan. So the binding of Satan took place when Jesus was here the first time. And the 1,000 years is seen as symbolic of an indefinitely long period of time, which we are living in. And then the destruction of Satan and of the wicked, when fire comes down from heaven at the end of the 1,000 years, is seen as the second coming of Christ. Because Paul said in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 and verse 8 that Jesus will come in flaming fire, taking vengeance on those who don't know God and who do not obey the gospel. So Christ will come in flaming fire. And so also we see fire from heaven coming down at the end of the millennium in Revelation 20. Then you've got the resurrection and the judgment. Now, the resurrection and the judgment are spoken of many times in Scripture. Some of these other things are not mentioned many times, but one thing or two things are mentioned very many times in Scripture, and that is the judgment and also the resurrection. Now, both of these happen at the end of the 1,000 years in Revelation 20. You have the 1,000 years, you have the fiery judgment of Satan and his people, then you have the resurrection and the judgment. Now, everywhere else in the Bible, when the resurrection and the judgment are discussed, they are placed at the second coming of Christ. When Jesus comes, he raises the dead, and he judges everybody. That's what Jesus said. That's what Paul said. That's what James said. That's what Peter said. That's what everybody said, whoever talked about it in the Bible. The judgment and the resurrection occur when Jesus comes back. Well, obviously, in Revelation 20, they occur at the end of the 1,000 years, so the coming of Christ must be at the end, not the beginning of the 1,000 years. And the binding of Satan at the beginning is what Jesus accomplished at his first coming. And what that means, of course, is that there's been a decisive victory over Satan accomplished at the cross. And although the language of Revelation is very symbolic and impressionistic, of course, nonetheless, it talks about that defeat that Christ accomplished at the cross against Satan. Now, the 1,000 years then simply refers to the whole period of time between the first coming of Christ and the second coming of Christ. We're living during that time now. Now, if somebody says, but that's been more than 1,000 years. Now, that's not an important problem, because the number 1,000 in Scripture is used repeatedly as an indefinitely large number. It's not a reference to a literal 1,000. And anyone can prove that to himself by simply getting a concordance out and looking at all the times that 1,000 is used in the Old Testament or the New. And you'll find it is always used to be an indefinitely large number, like a day to the Lord is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years like a day, or God keeps his covenant to 1,000 generations, or a day in your house is better than 1,000, or he owns the cattle on 1,000 hills, or many other places where 1,000 is used. It's not used of a literal number. It's used of simply an indefinitely large number. So the 1,000 years that Satan is bound is simply a figurative way of saying a very long time of indefinite length. So that is how the amillennialist sees it. Now, one of the main differences then between amillennialism and premillennialism is that amillennialists believe that Jesus is reigning now and the saints are reigning with him. And the premillennialist believes that Jesus is not really reigning over the kingdom as was predicted, but he will come and sit on the throne of David at his second coming and then will begin his reign. Now, the New Testament writers all speak as if Jesus is reigning currently and say that Jesus sat at the throne at the right hand of God and has been reigning ever since his ascension. So this, again, is a very important thing. Is Jesus the king now, or is he the loser now, but later to be vindicated as king? I believe he's the king now, and I think that's what the Bible proclaims everywhere in the New Testament. Now, you asked about the first resurrection and the second resurrection. In Revelation chapter 20, verses 5 and 6, it talks about saying, well, it says this is the first resurrection. These people who are with Christ are the first resurrection. And it says the rest of the dead don't live again until the 1,000 years are over. Now, the first resurrection is referred to in John's other major work, which is the Gospel of John. John wrote Revelation, of course, and he wrote the Gospel of John. And in John chapter 5, Jesus said that in John 5:24, he said, if anyone hears my words and believes in him that sent me, they have eternal life and shall not come into condemnation, but have passed from death into life. So a person who is now a believer has passed from death into life. Now, when someone's dead and then they come into life, that's called a resurrection. And that's the first resurrection that we have had. The second one we will have at the end of the world, when our bodies have been buried and Jesus comes and raises our bodies from the dead. That's the second resurrection for us. Now, there's only one resurrection as far as physical resurrections go. The Bible makes that very clear, that there's an hour coming in which all who are in the graves will come forth, the good and the bad. So all the dead will be raised when Jesus returns. That's a single physical resurrection. There's not two physical resurrections. But to the believer, that will be the second resurrection, because the believer has already experienced a first resurrection in this life. That's a coming from death to life, spiritually speaking, as Jesus said in John 5:24. Or as Paul said in Ephesians chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, and other places, Colossians chapter 2 also, verse 11 or so. There's a number of places that talk about how when we have come to Christ, we have come out of death into life. And that is the first resurrection. The second resurrection we await until Jesus comes back. Anyway, that's the short answer. And it doesn't seem short, but that's a big subject. So we're going to call that the short answer. Let's talk to John from Portland, Oregon. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. A friend of mine mentioned a term to me that he called compatibilism. And apparently it's a theological or philosophical term that he said somehow combines man's free will or makes man's free will compatible or incorporates it into God's predetermined will. Have you heard of that at all?
Yes, yes, that's what modern Calvinists say they believe in, for the most part, is compatibilism. Now, what they're dealing with is the fact that it seems illogical to say that everything has been predestined by God before we're ever born, and at the same time to say we have free will. Because if God has determined what's going to happen, and that's predetermined, and you know nothing else is going to happen except what he predetermined, and then we say that we have free will, we're kind of getting confused. Because if God determined it, then we don't have free will. We have to do exactly what he predetermined. And so that has been an objection that people have raised to Calvinism, because Calvinism teaches that God has foreordained everything. And so some people have felt that that's a flaw in Calvinism, because the Bible seems to teach free will. Now, some Calvinists don't teach compatibilism. Some Calvinists believe that there is no free will. They believe that God has foreordained everything and that the Bible never uses the term free will, and we shouldn't think of it as a biblical doctrine, that people are not free to make choices. They are predestined. And this would be non-compatibilism. This is something that some Calvinists hold. But most modern Calvinists that I've heard of or read hold to compatibilism. And what that means is they believe that free will of man is compatible with God having foreordained everything. And that's just it. In other words, they believe that what seems philosophically absurd to us is nonetheless true. And and therefore they say that human free will is compatible with God's having ordained everything. Now, to me, compatibilism is unnecessary, because the Bible does not say that God has ordained everything. And it does certainly teach that man has a free will, at least free enough to be responsible for what he chooses. And if you're trying to combine two things that aren't easily combined, for example, if we say God knows the future, but we still have free will, those things are hard to combine too. But the Bible does declare both of those things to be true. The Bible does say that God knows the future. And it also indicates that we have free will and responsibility. So somehow those two things must be true, even if we don't know how they are true. But it's not the same problem when we say you've got God ordaining everything that's going to happen on the one hand, and yet we have the power to choose what we will ordain to be for us on the other hand, because that's not free. If it's already been determined what I'm going to do by God's decision, then I'm not making the decision. He is. And to say, well, we believe that those two things are compatible, is compatibilism. However, just saying that we believe they are compatible doesn't mean they are. No one can show how it is that God could ordain everything that I'm going to do before I'm born, and yet I'm free to do whatever I want to do differently. That doesn't make sense. But we don't have to face that dilemma, because the Bible does not say that God ordained everything that happens. So we don't have to try to find a way to make that compatible with the other teaching of Scripture about free will.
Let me ask you before I hang up, for you to be as on top of it as you are on all of these topics, and I know that it can be easy to forget certain things, how much do you have to continue to study on a weekly basis just out of curiosity?
Well, I don't know how much I have to study, because I study for the joy of study, and I would, whether I had to or not, I'd always be studying. I study all the time, but I don't consider that I have to, although I think it's a responsible thing for me to do. I could have answered that question without having done any study in the last 10 years, just because I've studied that in the past. And that's true of a lot of the things that I'm asked about, because I've been teaching the Bible for 40 years. And so many of the things that I'm asked about now are things that I studied out, you know, just about every side of the issue 10 or 20 or even 30 years ago. And so I don't have to study them now in order to remember them. But on the other hand, I like to study them. So I still do. I still study all kinds of things. I haven't studied anything about that particular point in the last year or two, probably. But I, when there's new stuff that comes out, I like to read it.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, John, God bless you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, we're going to talk next to Lee from Salinas, California. Hi, Lee. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. I have a quick question for you on Rome chapter 14, verse 21. It said do not eat meat or drink wine. And I wonder who to make this. Is it God make this law, or just we answer that?
Well, this is simply a reference to the law of love. He says, I know, let me see, it's not verse, it's verse 21, right? Yeah, he says, it is good neither to eat meat nor to drink wine nor to do anything by which your brother stumbles or is offended or made weak. So if something stumbles your brother, then it's a good thing not to do it, Paul said, because there is a law of love that we want to do the loving thing. And it's not a loving thing to stumble somebody. And so that's what Paul's saying. He's not saying that there's anything intrinsically good about not eating food, or that there's anything intrinsically good about not drinking wine. He's saying that it is not good to do anything that will stumble your brother, because that's unloving.
Oh, okay. So I'm misunderstanding.
Yeah, you need to follow his train of thought there.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, Lee. Thanks for your call.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye now. All right. We're going to talk next to Eric from Portland, Oregon. Eric, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Steve. I got a question on the Lord's Supper. From what I can understand, that happened right around the time of Passover, and Luke describes it as him equating the Lord's Supper with the Passover, that the Passover is going to be fulfilled in what he's about to do. And so my question is, do you see any reason why since Passover was eating a lamb, why didn't he use the lamb's meat and the cup the lamb's meat to represent his body being broken, rather than the bread? Was it just because of the festival of unleavened bread was part of the Passover, or do you think it was another reason why he didn't use meat to signify his body being broken?
Well, I think he could have used either if he wished, but since he was going to use the cup, I think it was more normal and natural to use the bread as the other alternative, because they were taking the cup and the bread in symbolic fashion, whereas the lamb, they ate as food. They ate the lamb for nourishment. Of course, we believe it symbolized Jesus, but it was the lamb was their regular meal. But the ritual of the Passover involving the use of the matzos and of the cups and so forth was what he thought to transform into a ritual remembering his own death and his body and blood that is shed. So, I'm not sure why he, he could have used the lamb if he wished to, and yet that's, the bread works just fine. The bread and the cup work to represent his body and blood just fine. So I don't know why he didn't do something different.
Do you see any significance? I guess that's what I'm looking for. Do you think there's any significance to him anywhere else in Scripture, the fact that he did use the bread?
Well, of course, it's unleavened bread we're talking about here. And Paul speaks about us keeping the feast, the unleavened bread feast, with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth, and not with the leaven of malice and wickedness. This is in 1 Corinthians 5:8, I think. And so, I think that he's talking about unleavened bread speaks of the moral purity. And so I believe that he's referring to his own self as like being like unleavened bread, morally pure. But I don't really know, I don't know all of his reasons that were behind it. There's obviously a lot of symbolism in the feast in general and in the ritual. And he co-opted it to be a remembrance of himself. But I can't give all the reasons why he didn't do certain other things.
Okay. But it's clear that he is the fulfillment of the Passover, that he is the ultimate Passover lamb.
Well, that's what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5:7. He says, Christ, our Passover, has been sacrificed for us.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that.
Okay, Eric. Sorry, I don't know the answer to your basic question there.
No, that's okay. I knew it was just an oddball question that I've been thinking about, so I thought I'd try it on you and see what you thought.
Yeah, if there's some real profound significance to why he did it that way instead of the other way, I'm not sure that I'm aware of it.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Thank you.
Okay, Eric. Good talking to you. Let's talk to Scott in Las Vegas, Nevada next. Scott, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I had I don't know if it's a question or comment, or maybe you could, put a spin on it and see your perspective on it. The way I've seen it with the interpretation of, like, when they talk about the rapture and the second coming, I think a lot of times when people say the second coming is they intertwine them. But I see it as two separate events. His first coming was he actually came to the ground and he was actually on the earth. He put his foot on the ground and he was humble. And the second coming is he actually comes to the ground and he's not humble. He's in glory. He's with his angels. He's with his saints. He has power. And when they talk about the rapture, they never say rapture in the Bible, but they say meeting in the clouds. That's when he brings his saints up. And the way I've seen it, and maybe you have a different thing, is he brings his saints up, and whether you're pre-tribulation, mid, or post, he brings his saints up into the clouds. The saints meet him in the clouds, and then the tribulation happens, or wherever is your viewpoint, and then the 1,000 years goes on. He binds Satan, and then after that, Satan's loose, and that's when the final battle of Armageddon takes place. Then he comes on the earth again with power and destroys Satan and the people that have been bound up. That's the final battle.
That's a pretty good summary of, pretty much what dispensationalism teaches. I personally have a different viewpoint, but I used to teach that myself, so I know I understand it very well. Yeah.
Okay, because that's where the second coming and the where you said the 1,000 years can't happen. Well, if you had two separate events, one was meeting in the clouds and one was the second coming, then that would allow the 1,000 years to take place.
Well, I don't know anybody who thinks the 1,000 years takes place between the rapture and the second coming. Most dispensationalists believe there's a 7-year tribulation between the rapture and the second coming, but they don't believe the 1,000 years happens during that time. They believe the 1,000 years happens after Jesus comes back to earth. They believe the millennium happens then.
Okay.
Anyway, thanks for sharing that.
All right, thanks.
All right, bye now. Let's talk to Joel from Lake Oswego, Oregon. Joel, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My question is, what's the difference between the apostles' doctrine and the commands of Christ?
All right, yeah, I have that question down. You wrote to me the other day, and I haven't gotten to it, so I'm glad you got through today, because I might not have gotten to it very quickly. The doctrine of Christ and the doctrine of the apostles, you mean what's the difference in terms of their authority?
Well, no, not that. Just so obviously when Jesus in Matthew 28:19-20 says, teach them all I've commanded you.
Yeah.
And then later in Acts, you see they were devoted to the apostles' doctrine. And I'm just curious if that's the same thing, if they're slightly different.
I think it's the same. I think when the apostles taught the church in the book of Acts, they taught them what Jesus taught them to teach. I think they were fulfilling the Great Commission there. So I think when the apostles taught daily the new converts, what they were teaching was the curriculum, was what Jesus had commanded Christians to do. Now, the apostles' teaching, I believe, went beyond what Jesus taught it. In some cases, they had to make application of some of the principles that Jesus taught without Jesus having ever discussed every application. Paul, therefore, had to apply questions of divorce to people who were married to non-believers, which Jesus had never discussed that, because Jesus only had talked to people who were believers and their wives were also Jewish of the same faith as themselves. So Jesus gave certain teachings and the apostles sometimes had to go beyond it for new situations that Jesus never addressed. But in doing so, they had to apply the same principles that Jesus had taught to new situations.
I believe that
obedience to the apostles' teaching is the same as obedience to Christ's teaching.
Can I ask another question based on your answer?
Uh-huh.
So you took the example of divorce, and I believe it's back in Ezra, where they were commanded to divorce their foreign wives.
Yes, that was they were, although they were commanded by Ezra, but not by God to do that. But it may have been the right thing to do. It's hard to say. We're not told whether it was the right thing for him to give that command or not. We're just told that he did give that command.
So that was description as opposed to prescription.
Right. Well, I mean, the Bible itself records that they were told by Ezra to do that. We're not told that Ezra was inspired by God or that God had instructed him to say that.
Sure. I've always looked at that and said, man, I don't know how... That's a hard one.
Well, Paul tells us that if a Christian is married to a non-Christian, they should not divorce them. So that'd be different than what Ezra said.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. Thanks so much for your time, and hopefully I saved you time and not having to email me back.
Yeah, I appreciate your call. I'm glad you got through.
Thanks.
God bless you.
Bye.
Bye. There's a couple other people who've written in questions I haven't been able to get to because of the number of calls. I'm going to take at least one of these right now, and hopefully another one before very long. Our lines have just cleared if you want to get on. You're listening to The Narrow Path, and you can be on by calling 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. This question comes from a listener named Ty, and he's referring to something I said on the show Monday, just 2 days ago now. And he said yesterday, he wrote this to me Tuesday, he said yesterday on The Narrow Path, you answered a question about supersessionism. Now, by the way, if you weren't listening and you don't know what supersessionism is, it is the same thing that people sometimes call replacement theology. He says you answered a question about supersessionism and equated Judaism with Islam and Satanism. He says Judaism is as practiced before Christ was God instituted and sanctioned, as we see, by Christ fulfilling the law and the prophets. Islam and Satanism never were instituted or sanctioned by God at any time in history. By the logic you are employing, you could say that reading the Quran or the Satanic Bible is the same as reading the Torah or the Old Testament. Please address this on your show. Okay, well, first of all, I should clarify, I didn't equate Judaism with Islam or Satanism, although I do in one sense do so. They are all in one category together, and that is they are all religions that reject Christ. They are all religions that say that Jesus is not the Messiah. Satanism, Islam, and Judaism all have that in common. But that's not necessarily what I did. When I mentioned Satanism, I was trying to clarify that when we talk about Jews, we have to distinguish between whether we're talking about people who are racially Jews or people who are part of the religion of Judaism. Remember that if you were listening, the distinction was, is a person, when we say they're a Jew, is it because of their ethnicity, their race, their ancestors, or is it because of their religion? Because many people who are not ethnic Jews have embraced the Jewish faith and therefore would be called Jews. Likewise, many people who are ethnic Jews have not embraced the Jewish faith. Many ethnic Jews are not Jewish in religion. They either are atheists or Buddhists. Some of them are Christians, and they're not part of the Jewish faith. And therefore, if we call them Jews, we're speaking strictly of their ethnic origins. So when we say someone is a Jew, we should be very clear in our minds of whether we're referring to them as someone who's got Jewish ancestry, on the one hand, or somebody who's got Jewish beliefs. Now, we were talking about the difference because I said I don't have anything against Jewish people with Jewish ancestry. I do have complaints about Jewish beliefs in the Jewish religion because, like all religions that are not Christian, it rejects Christ. And Christians believe that Christ is the Son of God, that he's the only way to salvation. Christians believe that he is the Messiah. And John tells us in 1 John 2:22, anyone who denies that Jesus is the Christ, the same is Antichrist. Now, I didn't make that up. That's 1 John 2:22. Whoever denies that Jesus is the Christ is Antichrist, John said. Now, Judaism denies that Jesus is the Christ. So does Islam. So does Satanism. In that sense, all of those religions are Antichrist because they deny that Jesus is the Christ. And that there's only one biblical definition of Antichrist, and that's that. So, in comparing them, I wasn't actually even making that point. What I was actually saying there is that when I introduced the idea of Satanism, I said if it happened that all Anglo people or that all Satanists were Anglo people or the majority of Satanists were Anglos, then if someone said I am opposed to Satanism, that doesn't mean they're making a racist statement against Anglos. It just, and if it turns out that Anglos typically were Satanists, and Satanists typically were Anglos, and someone said, I am opposed to Satanism, that would not be a racist statement. Likewise, saying I'm opposed to Judaism is not a racist statement. It's a comment about a religion. Judaism is a religion. It's an anti-Christian religion. And so I would be opposed to Judaism in the same sense I'd be opposed to Satanism or Islam or Buddhism or whatever. I'm not opposed to people having whatever beliefs they may wish to have. I'm certainly tolerant of people having the right to believe what they want to believe, even if it's not Christian belief. But I'm opposed to their beliefs. That is to say, I believe their beliefs are wrong, and I would refute them if I was asked about them. So that's what I was saying about Judaism. Now, I would say this. Ty, who wrote this objection, said Judaism, as practiced before Christ, was God-instituted and sanctioned as we see Christ, by Christ fulfilling the law and the prophets. And he says, therefore, by my logic, that is my Steve Gregg, my logic, he says that you could say that reading the Quran and the Satanic Bible is the same as reading the Torah or the Old Testament. No, that's not true. Not true. Jesus did not practice Judaism as it is practiced today. Judaism today is a different religion than the religion that Jesus practiced as a Jew. You see, Judaism in the Bible was that which you find in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, the law of Moses. Moses established the Jewish religion. I mean, God did, but Moses was the instrument. Moses was the prophet through whom Judaism, the true Jewish religion, was established. And that was about a temple or a tabernacle. That was about an altar, a holy of holies, a priesthood, animal sacrifices. That's what it was about. Now, we don't have Jews doing that. We don't have Jews. The Jews don't have a temple. They don't have a priesthood. They don't have a Holy of Holies. They don't have an Ark of the Covenant. They don't have an altar. They don't have animal sacrifices. They don't have anything that Judaism was in the Bible. Now, when Jesus was here, they had all that, and Jesus was an observant Jew. Jesus was Jewish, and he observed the faith of his ancestors. And he always pointed out that the Pharisees weren't really observing the faith of their ancestors because they were following the traditions of their elders rather than the law and the prophets. That's what Jesus said. Now, the traditions of the elders that the Pharisees were following are now what we call the Talmud. In the days of Jesus, they had not been written down yet. They were orally transmitted traditions from the rabbis. But in the 3rd century, many of them were written down, and in the 5th century, some more were. And these traditions became what we call the Talmud. Now, modern Judaism isn't, they don't have a temple, they don't have a sacrifice, they don't have priests, they don't have anything that that the Jewish religion and Bible had. What they have is the Talmud. And therefore, what we call Judaism today really is Talmudism. And Talmudism is not the religious that, the religion that Jesus practiced. It's actually a religion that Jesus criticized. So that's a mistake. Now, to say that reading the Quran or the Satanic Bible is like reading the Old Testament is silly. I mean, Jesus read the Old Testament and preached from it. So did Paul and Peter and so forth. What they didn't do is preach from the Talmud, because Jesus believed in the Old Testament, and so do I. And therefore, I believe that reading the Old Testament is a good thing, too. But we need to read it through the Christian revelation that Jesus has given, rather than read it with the blinders on and seeing it only the way the rabbis did who didn't know Jesus. So I think the criticism is mistaken, but I'm glad you raised it so I'd have a chance to clarify those things. Let's talk to Curtis from Vancouver, Oregon. Hi, Curtis. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Vancouver, Washington is really. Go ahead.
Yeah, I live in Oregon, but I'm in Vancouver today. So
I see.
God bless.
I see.
Yeah, God bless you today. Hey, listen, I just saw change the subject here a little bit. First of all, just to tag on to that last comment, I want to confess that Jesus is the Christ, and he is the only way for salvation.
Amen.
Yeah, he's the fulfillment of righteousness in my life. I've heard an argument this week, and I just would ask you to explain it a little more than what I understood. There's kind of an argument about the date that the book of Revelation was written. Some people are saying it was written past 70 A.D., so it couldn't be talking about what went on in 70 A.D.
Right.
Could you explain the both sides of that for me real quick, and I'll listen on the radio, Stephen?
Okay, sure.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Curtis.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, there are two general theories about when Revelation was written. One theory is that it was written during the reign of Caesar Nero. And Nero was dead by 68 A.D., so if Revelation was written during the reign of Nero, then Revelation was written before 70 A.D., since Nero died in 68. And therefore, Revelation could be a prediction of the destruction of Jerusalem on that view. The other view is that it was written during the reign of Domitian. And Domitian reigned until about 96 A.D., but it obviously about 25 years after the fall of Jerusalem. And so, if the Revelation was written during the reign of Domitian, then it was, could not be predicting the fall of Jerusalem, because the fall of Jerusalem happened in 70 A.D., and a book written in 96 A.D. cannot be predicting an event that happened 25 years earlier. So, that certainly is a view widely held. Now, it probably would be safe to say that the majority of modern scholars do accept the later date. I think most of the study Bibles and lots of the modern commentaries just assume that the late date is correct, that Revelation was written in 96 A.D. If that is true, then of course that means that there's no possibility that Revelation was written to predict the fall of Jerusalem. And that means that one of the three other views has to be correct. If Revelation was written that late, then either the futurist view must be correct, or the idealist view, or the historicist view. A late date does not prove the dispensational view by any means. It simply reduces the options. A late date means that the book of Revelation either has to be futurist, idealist, or historicist in its understanding, but it could not be preterist in the sense of predicting 70 AD. Now, on the other hand, just because most modern scholars seem to favor the late date, that doesn't mean that there's not an excellent number of scholars who favor the early date. There's a great number of scholars. It would seem to me a growing number of scholars these days, in the past few decades, who believe it was written before 70 AD, written during the reign of Nero. And this was the majority view of scholars in the 1900s. The opinion shifted in the 20th century. I should say it was the majority view in the 1800s, in the 19th century, that's what I meant. And so in the 20th century, the opinion shifted, and more scholars tended to go for the late date. So it remains controversial. I believe the evidence is much better for the early date than for the late date. I don't have time to go into all the arguments because there's about 7 or 8 arguments for the late date and a similar number of arguments for the early date. But just we don't determine what's more likely to be true by counting up the number of arguments. We have to weigh the arguments. And I, on a show like this, I can't go over 16 arguments and tell you what's weak and what's strong about each of them. But I do that in my book, if you're interested in getting my book, Revelation 4 Views, a Parallel Commentary. I do, in the introduction, weigh the arguments for each of the dates theories. But I personally believe the early date has much better support within the book of Revelation itself than the late date does. But you will find a lot of people who think otherwise. Okay, let's talk to Bill from Mount Vernon, Washington. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi. How you doing? I spoke to you before, and I recently found the dispensationalist view to be mixed up and confusing, and I'm trying to get my place in as far as what the last days are concerned. And the one thing that confuses me now is the what they call the replacement doctrine of as far as the relationship between the Jewish people and the church. And the one thing, and then of course people emphasize the return of, that there's now a state of Israel and so forth, and that plays a big part in it. So the thing that I'm least able to understand is my question is, where do you place Armageddon in your viewpoint of the last days? And also you just mentioned the book that I'm sure I would like to get a hold of if you could tell me how to do that.
Okay. Well, the book is my book, which was published by Thomas Nelson back in 1997, and it's still available through ordinary book sellers like Amazon.com and ChristianBook.com and so forth. You can pick it up. It's called Revelation 4 Views, a Parallel Commentary by Steve Gregg. I don't sell it because I don't sell anything. I'm not a salesman. But okay. You can buy it through Amazon or through Christian Book Discount. So that's where that book can be found. As far as the Armageddon question, Armageddon is mentioned only in Revelation 16. It's not mentioned elsewhere.
You don't think that scriptures in Zechariah have to do with Armageddon?
Well, they might, but they don't mention Armageddon by name. There certainly is a battle there. There's a great battle in Zechariah 14, verse 1. And it might even be the same battle that is referred to as Armageddon in Revelation, but it doesn't say that it is. We have to remember that there's lots of battles in the Bible. The prophets talk about battles all the time.
How about in the 12th chapter, I believe it is, when it talks about that they will look upon him whom they have pierced and mourn for him, and then there'll be a fountain
I believe that happened. It says that God will pour out the spirit of supplication and so forth upon them. I think the spirit was poured out at the day of Pentecost. I believe they looked on him whom they pierced when he was crucified. I believe that there was a turning to God among the remnant of Israel in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost. I think that was a fulfillment of that.
Okay. All right. But as far as I'd always had it that it would be when Armageddon would be when
I know.
All these different nations would be against the modern state of Israel. And I don't know.
Right. That's the popular view. That's the dispensational view today. Yeah. It's held today very widely it was not held throughout church history for very long. It's a relatively new viewpoint. I think it's unlikely to be true. I mean, I taught it myself. I taught dispensationalism for 8 years, and I always taught those passages from a dispensational point of view, but I no longer think that it has very much biblical support.
Yeah, and can you spell your last name for me for ordering that book?
My last name is G-R-E-G-G, Greg.
Okay, I don't hear very well, so all right, thank you.
Okay, just look up Revelation 4 Views at Amazon and you'll find it.
Okay.
All right, now. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, let's talk to Keith from Newburgh, Oregon next. Keith, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. This is just a basic question. Thank you for your work, Steve.
Sure.
In Genesis, it talks about God made the firmament, created the firmament, and then he separated the waters from above and then the waters below. Can you explain what your opinion of the waters above? Is there waters above the heavens, in your opinion?
Well, the firmament there, there's at least three different views that I know about that, okay? But I'll tell you what I think is the most likely view, but I just want you to know there's some other people hold different views. I take the view that I think has been most often taken throughout history by evangelicals, and that would be that the firmament that he refers to there is what we might call the atmosphere of the earth. It's the air around us. It's not outer space. Now, it's true. It's true that later in Genesis chapter 1, it talks about God putting in the firmament the stars and the great light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night and so forth, which is talking about outer space. But the word firmament just means an expanse, and so it's a generic term. I believe that on day number 2, he created an expanse, that is a distance between waters that were above and below, and the space in between was what we call the atmosphere. And there was distilled waters up in either in the clouds, or as some people believe, that many Christians believe, there was a vapor canopy at the outer edge of the atmosphere that kind of shielded the earth from some of the more damaging effects of the sun's light and distributed the heat around the world a little more evenly. So there are some people believe that there was this vapor canopy out at the edge of the atmosphere. Others believe it's just a reference to clouds, where the water is up in the clouds, but that would be the water above the firmament, and then the waters below the firmament would be the terrestrial waters that we have right here on Earth. Now that's a fairly common view, and therefore the firmament or the expanse that God created in on day 2 would be the expanse between the Earth with its waters and the waters up in the sky, which become rain later on.
Okay. Thank you very, very much.
Okay, Keith, thank you for your call.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, we have another question that's been written in that's Timothy from Salem has actually written this some time ago, and I have not had a chance to get around to it, so let me take it. He says, I have one question. Could you tell me or your listeners more about the Sacred Names movement? They've completely taken over Salem, Oregon Christian radio, such as I'd not even call it a Christian station anymore. Their pseudoscientific, their pseudoscience is terrible. They're misleading a lot of people. I've heard people become depressed and lose faith because of the Sacred Names. People keep telling us that Orthodox Christianity is a pagan lie. Their stated goal is to convert every pastor in Salem to their cause, and they claim to have already been successful with some. He says, I know you briefly answered a question about this a few weeks ago, but I hope to warn your listeners that this movement, which seems less Christian even than Mormonism, about the same, is completely errant. I can't stand them, he says, telling us over and over that Jesus equals Zeus, God is a bad word, Christmas and Easter are evil, the word Christian is corrupt, everyone must speak mashup of quasi-Hebrew and New Testament, and that the New Testament was actually written in Hebrew, not Greek, hence you should read no translation but theirs. It's even wrong to use the title Christ. We must use the more Hebrew-sounding Messiah, along with the Torah and the Tanakh, etc., etc. Now, if you haven't heard of this movement, I've encountered it a number of times. This is people who, as the writer Timothy wrote this from Salem, Timothy tells us quite correctly, these people say you have to start using the sacred name, but they can't always agree about how it's pronounced. Yah or Yahweh or some name like that, or Yeshua or Yahashua is a name for Jesus, or Yeshua. There's all these different Hebrew, alleged Hebrew pronunciations. And these people are just really hung up on Hebraisms, on being Hebrew as much as possible, even though they're not Hebrews. These are Gentiles in many cases who are, they just want to be Jewish. And as far as I'm concerned, they can become Jewish if they want to, but that's a different religion than Christianity. Now, but they are so enamored with all things Jewish that they feel like you have to start speaking something Hebrew-like. Start using the Hebrew names of God and Christ and Jesus and so forth. They make the most outlandish and silly claims. For example, they say that Jesus, or Jesus in the Greek, is based on the word Zeus. Well, they're quite mistaken. Jesus is simply a transliteration of the name Yeshua, which is the Hebrew name for Jesus. The Greek language does not have an SH sound. And so Yeshua becomes Jesus. And, you know, it's a transliteration. The name Zeus has nothing to do whatsoever with the word Jesus. The sound of it is similar. But that's the problem with the Hebrew names movement. They have no scholarship behind them. They just make things up as they go along. They say, for example, that Christ comes from the word Krishna. Well, that's not true at all. Krishna is, I think, a Sanskrit word, if I'm not mistaken. And I once knew what it meant, but it doesn't mean Christ. Christ is from the Greek word anointed. And it's just the Greek form of the name Messiah, of the word Messiah, which is Hebrew. Hebrew means anointed, and Christos means anointed. So Christ is from Christos. It's not from Krishna. And, you know, it's just the silly things that they say. They say that the New Testament was originally written in Hebrew. Well, that'd be really amazing if Paul, writing to the Greeks in Corinth, who, you know, wrote to them in Hebrew. Oh, they wouldn't be able to read a word of what he said. Likewise, the Thessalonians, you know, they'd only been saved out of paganism for 3 weeks when he wrote 1 Thessalonians. And he's going to write to them in Hebrew? Why? They wouldn't be able to understand it at all. Why would he write to these people in Hebrew? We don't have any evidence that he did. In fact, the only evidence we have from the Church Fathers is that Matthew did write an early draft of his book in Hebrew, but that it was later translated into Greek by other authoritative writers. The rest of the New Testament books were written in Greek, not Hebrew. So the Sacred Names Movement, if you ever hear them, just know that they don't have any scholarship that makes any sense whatsoever. They're not honest, obviously, because they make things up as they go along, and they fabricate history. To my mind, that's a very dishonest thing to do. And it is a lot like the Mormon Church. It is an aberration of Christianity. It's not Christianity. It's just dividing the body of Christ and telling a lot of lies, too. Anyway, sometime ask me what I really think about those guys. You've been listening to The Narrow Path, and my name is Steve Gregg. We do this Monday through Friday from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock in the afternoons, Pacific time. We are a listener-supported ministry. And if you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, they are substantial. And we had some extra expenses this month. If you'd like to help us pay our bills, we can stay on the air. If you write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063, you can help us out. Or if you want to make a contribution using PayPal at the website, you can do that. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Now, there's nothing for sale. As I mentioned to an earlier caller, I don't even sell my own book. You can't buy my book for me because I won't sell a thing. I refuse to be a salesman. I'm just here to minister. But we do pay bills. And so if you'd like to keep this ministry going, you can help us out. The address again is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. And the website is www.thenarrowpath.com. Don't forget, I'll be in Henderson, Nevada this Friday, day after tomorrow. Information is at the website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk again tomorrow, Lord willing.